Sunstone Foundation presents Changed Faces, official LDS positions on polygamy, 1890-1980. Recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Thank you for attending this session of the Sunstone Theological Symposium. We offer you an interesting topic this morning, which I'm sure you will enjoy. The topic of our paper this morning, the name of it is Changed Faces, Official LDS Positions on Polygamy, 1890 to 1980. And the author of this paper is Martha Bradley. I met her for the first time about 1 minute ago, but this is a name, having worked with Sunstone, that I've been familiar with for years. She received a master's degree from BYU in American history and art history and is currently a PhD candidate at the University of Utah in community history and architectural history. She's been published in the Utah Historical Quarterly, and the emphasis of her dissertation is the child welfare movement from the 1890s through 1923. The commentor is Richard Van Wagner, once again another name that you're familiar with. He is an audiologist in Salt Lake, is the author of A Book of Mormons, which was published 3 years ago, about, and has a forthcoming book, which sounds very interesting, which should be a definitive history of Mormon polygamy, called Mormon Polygamy, A History, which will be available in October through Signature Books. We would like to have the paper for 30 minutes, the comment for 20 minutes, and if we have time, we would like to have questions from the audience after that. Thank you.
September 26, 1985, will be 5 years short of the centennial of the manifesto which ended polygamy. Yet this doctrine remains as part of our mythic historical past and a continuing principle of the gospel. It is a subject of persistent interest to those watching from inside the church and out. In this 95-year period, the church's attitude has changed dramatically from one of actively advocating the practice of polygamy to one in which polygamists are feared as a major threat to the integrity of the church. In their contempt of 20th century polygamists, Utah Mormons have become typical of conservative middle America. Much of the changed policy and attitude of the church has been reactionary, reflecting changed times rather than a change in doctrine. These adjustments also demonstrate a sort of changing of the guard through which a new generation of ecclesiastical leaders met the demands of the manifesto. These men emphasized the church's patriotism and loyalty to the laws and moral standards of American society. The church thus has entered into the mainstream of conservative American religious society. When Wilford Woodruff faced the prospect of leading the Latter-day Saints in 1890, the church was in disarray. Most church leaders were either in prison or in exile. John Taylor died while in hiding. The property of the church had been claimed by the United States government, and 5 attempts at statehood had failed. Nonetheless, it was only through personal revelation from God that President Woodruff was willing to change. The manifesto sought to end both the practice and the advocacy of the principle of plural marriage without specifying punishment for the disobedient. It was assumed that saints would be compelled to obey the measure when they considered its source. In addition, it declared the intention of the church to comply with the laws of the land. The period of active civil disobedience, sanctioned by John Taylor, had been ended. The manifesto created the first official division between the church body and the polygamists. By the mid-20th century, that division would become both broad and deep. The document raised almost as many questions as it answered. Many stubbornly refused to accept it as a revelation from God. Others were confused by its vague and ambiguous instructions for the future. Polygamous marriages continued to be performed in the period from 1890 to 1904 in greatly reduced numbers. Then followed a carefully qualified truce between the government and the Mormon Church, rather than a glorified era of goodwill. It would continue to be a crime either to marry polygamously or to cohabit with more than one woman. Polygamy again became the subject of heated debate during the Reed-Smoot hearings of 1903. in response to the pressure generated by the publicity surrounding the trials, and in an effort to reemphasize the legitimacy of the revelations ending the practice, Joseph F. Smith issued the Second Manifesto in 1904. This document denied allegations that any new polygamous marriages had been sanctioned by the church and declared that from that time forward, all violators would be excommunicated. The Second Manifesto rested on the coercive power of the threat of excommunication rather than the persuasive power of divine revelation. As polygamists themselves, Joseph F. Smith and other general authorities felt particular pressure to prove their willingness to enforce the prohibition on polygamy. Both Smith and Francis M. Lyman of the Council of the Twelve were chided on the witness stand at the Smoot hearings for not being firm enough with offenders. Although the official relationship between polygamy and the Latter-day Saints had been severed, polygamy was still a major concern of church leaders. A hardening of official policy is apparent in public addresses such as General Conference talks of the First Presidency, as they moved from advising against the practice to actively using the threat of excommunication. Examination of this body of public discourse indicates a shift in attitude from a faithful testimony of the principle to a secular detachment from the issue, illustrating how far and how quickly the church had moved from its 19th century antecedents. In a General Conference address in April 1904, President Joseph F. Smith gave a lengthy reiteration of the patriotic posture of the church and identified the constitutional question of freedom of religion as the justification for polygamy, rather than the traditional emphasis on the revelatory nature of the principle. Smith said, quote, "What our people did in disregard of the law and the decisions of the Supreme Court affecting plural marriages was in the spirit of maintaining religious rights under constitutional guarantees and not in any spirit of defiance or disloyalty to the government," unquote. According to Smith, the period of civil disobedience had ended only when every means of constitutional defense had been exhausted. It was then that the church abandoned the controversy and announced its intention to be obedient to the laws of the land. Citing the 12th Article of Faith, he pledged loyalty to the American system. What about the revelation? What about the 14 years that separate Reynolds versus the United States and the manifesto? What about Woodruff's personal battle with the idea? Apparently, by 1904, the perspective on polygamy had somehow altered, perhaps by the pressure generated by the Smoot hearings. Nevertheless, in its place, a new aggressive and assertive patriotism was being paraded before the nation. 20 years after the manifesto, plural marriages were still being performed without the official sanction of the president of the church. Again, Smith felt it necessary to clarify the church's position on plural marriage and to warn of the consequences of disobedience. In a letter of October 5, 1910, from the First Presidency to the stake presidencies of the church, direction was given to actively search out those who were actually performing plural marriages and had, as yet, evaded detection. This effort was primarily directed against those who were bringing others into the practice, although it also prescribed punishment for those who only advise or counsel. Obviously, continued adherence to the practice was no longer a matter of personal discretion. It had become an issue of disloyalty to the church and a failure to defer to the direction of the prophet. Disobedience was described as being, quote, "not only an individual transgression, but a dishonor to the church as well," unquote. It was necessary for Smith to remind the brethren again in 1911 of those instructions and to strengthen the directives by insisting that offenders be brought before a church court. Future operational instructions and policies were sent under the title of precepts, regulations, and rules, rather than as doctrine or updated revelation. These letters of policy were the precursors of the handbooks of instruction, which was first circulated in the 1910s. In a conference address in 1918, President Charles W. Penrose went beyond what had become a typical approach of using threats and making declarations of good faith and tried to explain more fully the doctrine of plural marriage to a new generation who were less familiar with the principle. Before the manifesto, the principle was of central importance to church doctrine and solidarity. In the 30 years since, a new generation of young members had been raised in the church who had no feeling for either the social or sacred nature of the practice. The Penrose discourse served as a reminder of both. It was divided into two main sections and clearly delineated the issues that would be of enduring significance in the Church's continued relationship with the doctrine. The doctrine of celestial marriage, as articulated by Joseph Smith, Jr., continued to be taught after the demise of plural marriage, and despite the fact that the two were so closely linked. Penrose portrayed Mormon marriage, celestial marriage, or the holy patriarchal order, as a privilege through which men and women were sealed together by the holy order of God. The purpose of celestial marriage was an abundant and faithful progeny. Quote, "Thy shall increase worlds without end in their prosperity, in knowledge, in wisdom, in understanding, in dominion, and in glory," unquote. Celestial marriage is detailed in the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants and is therefore sanctioned as a commandment of the Lord. This scripture defines celestial marriage as marriage for time and all eternity and a necessary prerequisite for the attainment of the highest degree of glory in the celestial world. Penrose then referred to another portion of that revelation which mentioned further orders of the holy order of marriage that were under special direction. The power, authority, and keys to perform celestial marriages were located only in the hands of the president of the church. "Read it carefully," he said. "The keys of that power are given to one man at a time in the earth, and you will see sometime, if you cannot now, the wisdom of that law. He holds the key of that power, and when he turns it, as Brother Woodruff did, it closes the door." The further order of the patriarchal order that Penrose was referring to was plural marriage. In the 19th century, the concept of plural marriage and the concept of celestial marriage, or the patriarchal order, were inextricably linked. This was still true in 1918. The issue in contention between the official church leadership and those practicing polygamy independently was the location of the power, or the keys, to perform such marriages. He then reiterated the position of church presidents Lorenzo Snow and Joseph F. Smith, who both said that at that time there was no man on earth who was authorized to perform plural marriages. Obviously, the purpose of Penrose's message was to combat the rumors about alternate priesthood authority and to ruin the credibility of those claiming authority to continue the practice. Recognizing the vulnerability of the new generation to these claims, he said, "Do not believe these stories that men who are seeking to indulge their own lust are circulating among the people, but try to guard the purity of our innocent girls, many of whom have never heard of such things, and these things are whispered in their ears by some designing person who is a rebel against the Church of Christ." In 1912, President Heber J. Grant bluntly addressed the subject of priesthood authority, leaving no doubt as to the Latter-day Saint viewpoint that the keys remained in the person of the prophet of the church. In an impassioned 1925 ruling, Grant claimed that the very integrity of the church was being impugned. President Grant would find it necessary to repeat these straightforward and candid warnings on at least four other occasions during his administration in an attempt to make his attitude, quote, "clear, definitive, and unequivocal as to leave no possible doubt," unquote. Another important change in the dialogue of the 1930s was the nature of the enemy. Thereafter, the church faced the more formidable power of organized fundamentalist polygamists who made alternate claims to priesthood authority to perform plural marriages. Future discussion on polygamy by church leaders in public discourse would be directed to the fundamentalists who were actively recruiting as well as circulating literature that criticized church leadership and that ignored members to ignore the manifesto. 2 years later, because of renewed interest in the, quote, "corrupt, adulterous practices of the members of this secret oath-bound organization," unquote, a definitive official statement from the First Presidency was drafted by J. Reuben Clark and published in the Church News section of the Deseret News. This assertion of church policy gave a careful accounting of the history of the controversy, which had raged since the 1890 manifesto. It summarized legal action, doctrinal support of the practice, and the continued practice of polygamy outside of Mormonism, again stressing the legal contractual nature of the marriage union and the legal discontinuation of the principle, rather than the fact that it had once been evidence of obedience to a commandment of God. With an erudite candor typical of Clark, the document virtually eliminated the possibility of misrepresentation of the church's policy. The LDS doctrine of celestial marriage was clarified for the saints as well. In this following statement, Grant made a careful distinction between celestial marriage and polygamous marriage, saying, quote, monogamous marriages for time and eternity solemnized in our temples in accordance with the word of the Lord and the laws of the church are celestial marriages, unquote. The logic that had been so carefully constructed to justify plural marriage was being just as carefully dismantled. It is difficult to try and guess the motives of President Smith or Grant or those of J. Reuben Clark as they increased their pursuit of offenders of the rule, but there are at least three factors which are of obvious importance. First, church leaders must have tired of the continued harassment of government and media personnel, the continued accusations and distrust of motives, and became embarrassed by their impotency in stopping the practice. Second, they wanted to resolve the constant confrontation with the fundamentalists, whose strident claims to priesthood authority hit directly at the position of the prophet, who, according to official church policy and doctrine, had sole rights to the keys of the ceiling. Finally, these men were surely affected in more personal ways as relatives and friends continued on a path that seemed to lead them from the fold. The highly publicized church trial of Alpha Higgs, who was a personal friend and colleague of President Grant, as well as the general secretary of the church's Young Men Mutual Improvement Association and assistant manager of the church publication The Improvement Era, must have particularly grieved and embarrassed Grant. J. Reuben Clark's 80-year-old uncle, John W. Woolley, was excommunicated from the church for performing plural marriages, a double-edged sword which must have both saddened and caused Clark great embarrassment in his public career in the East. Concern over internal dissension prompted one rather extraordinary gesture in the 1930s when the church subjected suspected fundamentalists to a loyalty oath. The first presidency was willing to try anything to stop the practice. The fundamentalist was required to repeat these words, quote, "I solemnly declare and affirm that I, without any mental reservation whatever, support the presidency and apostles of the church, that I repudiate any intimation that anyone of the presidency or the apostles of the church is living a double life, that I denounce the practice and advocacy of plural marriage, and that I myself am not living in such alleged marriage relationship," unquote. Directions to local ecclesiastical leaders included in the Handbook of Instructions for Dealing with Polygamists have changed very little between 1935 and 1985. During that 50-year period, no change has been made in policy or procedure. Instructions have always called for direct and immediate action. Plural marriages are branded adulterous relations and dealt with as such. In the Handbook of 1934, particular attention was drawn to those, quote, "teaching, encouraging, and entering into the practice," unquote, of plural marriage. If after diligent and prompt investigation of individuals purported to be practicing polygamy, evidence of violation was found, immediate excommunication from the church resulted. The lesser punishment of probation or disfellowship were disallowed in such cases. The excommunicated polygamists could be rebaptized only with the special permission of the First Presidency. By 1940, the Church of the Firstborn of the Fullness of Times presented the most united threat to the church from a schismatic group. Lauren Woolley organized the group in 1929, ordaining four excommunicated Mormons as leaders: J. Leslie Broadbent, John Y. Barlow, Joseph W. Musser, and Charles F. Zitting. In the 1940s, the group was actively recruiting new members through public meetings and through their publication, Truth Magazine. When the group had been reticent about their beliefs, the government and the church ignored them. When they appeared to be growing and threatened the status quo, action was taken to limit the practice. In 1944, federal and state law enforcement officers in Utah, Idaho, and Arizona arrested 46 polygamists. Barlow versus State et al., which was the group case, they grouped the cases together because they were so similar in their arguments. And this case took place in 1944. It focused on the constitutional argument that cohabitation was a religious belief and therefore protected by the Freedom of Religion Clause of the Constitution. Both the arguments and the proceedings had a familiar ring. They duplicated the polygamy trials of the 1880s, in which Mormon polygamists claimed protection under the Constitution and which the law was stretched by the government in the effort to quash the practice. But this group of cases was different in a very important way. Barlow and his fellow defendants were ostracized by both the state and their parent church. For the first time, the polygamists faced prosecution without the powerful sanction of the Mormon church. In fact, in an interesting twist of procedure, Mormon jurors seemed to pose a particular threat to the defendants in this case, and an effort was made to impeach them from service on the jury. The defense counsel believed that the trial was over before it began because of the makeup of the jury, the Mormon Church's support of the prosecution, at least as the polygamists perceived it, and what they called the campaign against the group. Many of these accusations were false, or at best, alarmist. There is, however, evidence that the church did supply information to the prosecution and cooperated in the government's effort against the group. Apostle Marky Peterson, in a statement to the United Press, which would later become part of the case file, remarked, quote, "The church has actively assisted federal and state authorities in obtaining evidence against the cultists and helping to prosecute them under the law. Among the witnesses for the prosecution are men who have been appointed by the church to search out the cultists, turning over such information as they gather to the prosecution for their use. These men have also been appointed by the church to do all they can to fight the spread of polygamy," unquote. At the time, the church was supplying information that had been gathered from internal surveillance activities to the Attorney General for use in the public in the polygamy cases. It was publicly disclaiming any part in the action. In these public statements, the church stressed that it had already dealt with the men in church courts with the most severe punishment, excommunication, and again they reasserted the importance of the separation of church and state. The procedure was similar during the 1953 raids on the fundamentalist community of Short Creek, Arizona. Again, the raid was conducted by state and federal officials, and the church made firm public statement that it had no involvement in the official raid and that they had dealt with the fundamentalists in church courts. The implication was, of course, that there was no connection between the church and the raid. However, Howard Pyle, the governor of Arizona, did keep church leaders informed about every step of the planning and the execution of the raid. In daily phone calls to Salt Lake City with Delbert Stapley of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, Pyle shared details and information to ensure that the church would not be offended by any of the steps taken. J. Reuben Clark and other church leaders knew of the raid at least 10 days before. The fundamentalists posed a threat to the church in three basic ways. The policies presented in the 1940 edition of the Handbook of Instructions reflected the effort to expeditiously deal with these threats. The less specific attack against the individual polygamists was strengthened by directing future efforts against the source of their support and the center of their power, those claiming to have continued authority to persist in the practice. The church's first concern was with the question of loyalty. In many ways, the church was like a large family bound by doctrine, ordinance, and custom. But fundamentalist polygamists were openly and stridently disclaiming both the church and the prophet. The schism between the fundamentalists and the LDS Church was like a bitter and destructive divorce in which both parties felt betrayed and misunderstood. A second concern of the LDS leaders was the growth of the fundamentalist movement in terms of numbers. Most new recruits to the group came from the ranks of the church itself. As fundamentalists recruited church members, they increased in both strength and influence. This self-perpetuating growth encouraged church leaders to stress again the importance of keeping the members informed about the threats posed by polygamy so that, quote, no one will be in ignorance of the falsity of the doctrines or of the illegality of the practices of this group, nor in doubt as to the spiritual falling away of its members and those who follow them, nor unaware of the church's disciplinary measures which must be taken against them, unquote. These rules and regulations were designed to help prevent saints from falling away. Third, they wanted to ensure that the polygamists could not partake of any of the rights and privileges appertaining to members, namely entry into the temples, payment of tithes, and the subsequent blessings, participation in the activities of the priesthood quorums or the auxiliary organizations of the church, or any other ward, stake, or church activities. This measure served to ostracize socially as well as spiritually the polygamists from the official church body. This was done both as punishment and to preserve the integrity of the sacred rites and ordinances. It is a curious phenomenon that while the individual fundamentalists scorned the church for its unrighteous denial of the practice, at the same time many continued to believe in the importance of temple work and other church programs, taking enormous risks, making tremendous sacrifices to secure recommends to enter the temples and to continue wearing the official temple garments. and an uneasy connection persists, if at no more than an unconscious psychological level, between those who practice the principle and those who believe in the doctrine, but not the practice. Mark Peterson worked to eliminate the practice of plural marriage by searching out the individual believer and utilizing surveillance techniques similar to those used in private investigation. After searching for and identifying a suspected polygamist, Peterson encouraged local leaders to watch their homes, to follow them to meetings or other gatherings, and to question them about their unexplainable behavior. And this information would then be used in a church court. The most obvious result of this reactionary behavior was the excommunication of large numbers of fundamentalist polygamists. An important residual effect was the manner in which it discouraged many members from healthy dialogue on the subject. At a time when only one-sided discussion of polygamy was permitted, when differing viewpoints were misread or seemed suspicious, the subject, in a very subtle way, became off-limits. There's only a fine line distinguishing the advocacy of an idea and simply arguing in its favor. And for many, any form of discussion about polygamy was simply too difficult to handle. Since 1950, the subject of plural marriage has rarely been mentioned in general conference or in any other public address to the saints. When it was, as in a talk given in 1974 by Spencer W. Kimball, another specialist in dealing with the fundamentalists, it was again to warn members not to associate with the various cults. Avoiding the subject rather than dealing with the questions it presented was one way of preventing confusion among the members or difficulties with the doctrine. Saints no longer hear elaborations on the doctrine of plurality of wives in conference addresses, nor do they listen to amusing anecdotes about the intricacies of polygamist pioneer life. The polygamist in Joseph Smith or Brigham Young is rarely acknowledged. It is as if the modern-day church has been divorced from a large and important part of its historical past. Under the priesthood correlation movement of the 1960s, the policy hardened. Polygamy was uniformly excluded from official church discussion in literature, lesson manuals, pamphlets, and public discourse. This omission was not backed by any written or official directive. It was more an unspoken yet pervasive assumption that difficult doctrinal or historical topics were not to be mentioned. The purpose of correlation was to ensure and to strengthen the spiritualities of the members. It was not to distribute definitive information through the teaching programs of the church. But questions about plural marriage continued to be raised when the church and its representatives faced the world. Polygamy was one subject that universally preceded further information about the Mormons. It was a well-known subject of historical inquiry. Despite that fact, important church representatives, like mission presidents, were usually given no specific written or formal direction about how to deal with questions on the subject. Potentially combative confrontations with the outside world are sometimes dealt with by the public communications department of the church. Again, no official policy. The policy seems to be instead to present an upbeat image of the church and to avoid difficult subjects like polygamy. The official church stopped talking about plural marriage in its meetings, manuals, and other publications in the 1950s. This does not mean that it was forgotten by the individual member. When it was resurrected as an issue from time to time, it was to warn the members of the dangers of associating with members of the fundamentalist cults. Where were the answers found? According to Bruce R. McConkie, in Mormon Doctrine, which is where many Mormons turn to find answers to doctrinal questions, the source of all definition is the scriptures. On the subject of plural marriage, McConkie refers the reader to two definitive scriptural justifications for the practice, Isaiah 4 and Doctrine and Covenants 1:32. According to these two passages, polygamy is accepted by the Lord when administered by those with a proper keys to the ordinance. The scriptures also describe it as part of the restitution of all things. McConkie concludes by saying, quote, obviously the holy practice will commence again after the second coming of the Son of Man and the ushering in of the millennium. The manifesto that ended polygamy is of very little help in explaining the doctrine of plural marriage. It suspended the practice but made no mention of the principle itself. Make the principle fit into Mormon theology. However, most of their energy was spent in punishing offenders and trying to halt the practice. The church's accommodation to the world, the reaching out for recognition, centered on shared experiences rather than on those practices, such as plural marriage, which functioned as boundaries. In addition, the policy of excommunication for polygamy, which received increased emphasis through the years, divided the fundamentalists from official church society and identified the church as a group which, like most of the rest of Middle America, scorned the practice. The Mormons moved from persecuted to prosecutor. As early as 1935, the Mormon doctrine of plural marriage no longer fit into the plan for the good life presented by the church's missionaries. It was relegated to a position of relative obscurity as a hypothetical condition of the afterlife that should not be questioned or necessarily understood until another time. Much of what we know and understand about the gospel comes from our local leaders. As children in primary, as women in Relief Society, or as men in priesthood classes, we listen, we discuss, and we learn. The gospel we know is in large measure the representation of that collection of opinion and interpretation. The church is, of course, first an organization of the saints. As gospel, it is a body of ideas, the combination of sacred text and, through a process much like judicial review, contemporary updated revelation that serves the needs of succeeding generations. In general conference addresses, the church president and general authorities tell the saints the word of God. The prophet ideally interprets the word, advises and sets patterns of behavior, and warns of potential trouble, hoping to promote the spirituality of the members. When a subject is left untouched, particularly for a long period of time, any interpretation, advice, and counsel given is done on the local level. At this level of religious experience, where each member attends a lifetime of church meetings, when doctrinal questions arise, more time is spent asking questions of each other rather than addressing those same questions to the scriptures themselves. The result is a sort of folk knowledge, perpetuated through oral tradition rather than through canonization in the written word. So where does the doctrine of plural marriage fit now? As it is taught today, the ideal of celestial marriage centers on the coupling of two righteous spirits whose ultimate destiny in terms of paradisical glory depends in large part on the success of that union. Books like Marriage and Divorce by Spencer W. Kimball make no mention of the further order of the patriarchal order of marriage, that is, the contingency of plural marriage in eternity. The concept of plural marriage is not part of the written or oral tradition of the modern-day church. It is as foreign to the contemporary Mormon as it might be to someone outside of the church. It is part of our mythic past, but not part of our contemporary tradition. The idea of plural marriage may not mesh well with the newly awakened feminism of the Mormon Relief Society sisters, nor does it fit well with today's common understanding of temple marriage or with modern economic realities. But in a church that persists in emphasizing obedience to continuous revelation and open canon, plural marriage does fit. It is a paradox that every Mormon may face eventually as a test of his or her faith. The answer to what the Mormon believes about plural marriage is in the scriptures. It is also, however, in what he hears in church and in the logic that he must take from history. Thank you.
In order to gain an understanding, a correct understanding of Mormon polygamy, it is important for the student of history to realize that church leaders often hold private positions that are in complete disagreement with the official position of the church. This has resulted in a multitude of serious problems. Aside from the political, legal difficulties this casuistry has caused, it may be directly linked to the rise of Mormon fundamentalism, a big thorn in the church's side. Martha's paper, which she informed me is part of a larger project concerning the legal prosecution of polygamists, is an important step in educating Mormons on the realities of our historical background. Mormon fundamentalists are everywhere in Utah. One of the best Spanish omelets in the Salt Lake Valley is served at a polygamist-owned restaurant. Customized draperies manufactured in a fundamentalist cottage industry enhance the windows of many of Salt Lake City's finest homes. One of Utah's most successful coal mines is a polygamous co-op. John Singer, a fundamentalist who refused to send his children to Utah public schools, was shot to death in 1979 by law enforcement officials in Summit County while resisting arrest. A small sect in Ogden, known as the Company, reportedly advocates divinely mandated lesbian practices as well as polygamy. Royston Potter and Alex Joseph were 1983 guests on the nationally syndicated Phil Donahue show. Leland Freeborn, a polygamous farmer from Parowan, announced in October of 1983 that in 40 days the United States would suffer nuclear attack from the Soviet Union. And we cannot forget the horrible consequences of fundamentalist brothers Ron and Dan Lafferty, who, believing that God directed their every step, murdered their sister-in-law and infant niece on the 24th of July, 1984. In the days before general authorities, voices were laundered by correlation and public relations departments. Church leaders spoke their minds. President John Taylor, militant polygamist and advocate of civil disobedience, said exactly what he thought of government interference in his domestic concerns. Quote, "The people of the rest of the country are our enemies. They do not understand us. We do not understand them. We should pray for them, but we must not yield to them. When they enact tyrannical laws forbidding us the free exercise of our religion, we cannot submit. God is greater than the United States, and when the government conflicts with heaven, we will be ranged under the banner of heaven and against the government. The United States says we cannot marry more than one wife. God says different." Unquote. Can anyone imagine a church leader issuing such a bold, seemingly anti-American statement today? We have indeed changed faces, as Martha has put it. Polygamists in the 19th century tended to be the cream of Mormon society. Federal opposition made the practice of plural marriage all the more a hallmark of loyalty to the faith. Yet during the 1930s, as Martha points out, the church, under the careful guidance of J. Reuben Clark, began extensive cooperative efforts with law enforcement officials to squash polygamy. How quickly we began to detest our polygamous brother and sisters. During a 5th of June 1939 meeting of Salt Lake City's Pioneer Stake, Stake President Paul C. Child instructed his bishops, quote, "that all those polygamists are in very humble circumstances, being practically destitute, and if we help them, we are helping to support plural families. Bishops were then ordered to withhold church relief from such families." A short time later, the presiding bishopric's office sent out a churchwide circular, Church Bulletin Number 223, to all stake presidencies and ward bishoprics, advising that children of polygamous parentage be denied the baptismal rites until old enough to, quote, repudiate the principle that gave them birth. More recently, a fundamentalist family moved into my mother's ward in Lehigh, prompting the bishop to announce during a sacrament meeting that ward members should not associate with them because they were polygamous. Unfortunately, they were not Baptists, Catholics, or Methodists with conversional potential. Polygs, cohabs, and the like seem unworthy of Mormon charity. As Martha points out, much of the change policy of the church towards polygamy has been reactionary. It comes from wanting to be accepted into mainstream America. Perhaps our 19th century church leaders grew tired of being recognized as a peculiar people. They certainly had grown tired of federal government and media opposition to polygamy when President Woodruff issued his manifesto. Despite President Woodruff's reference to inspiration and Martha and other scholars equating the manifesto with divine revelation, there were unquestionably political dimensions to the release of the statement, both to its content and its timing. The first presidency, public statements to the contrary, privately did not intend for plural marriage to be totally abandoned, nor for polygamists to continue or to discontinue connubial relationships with their plural wives. In 1891 court testimony, President Woodruff testified that his purpose in issuing the manifesto was to, quote, "announce to the world that plural marriage had been forbidden by the church in places outside of the United States as well as within the United States." Yet in 1900, after Woodruff's death, President George Buchanan, in explaining the situation to uninformed members of the Quorum of the Twelve, reviewed what had been the private posture of the hierarchy respecting new polygamy as plural marriage after the manifesto would be known. Quote, "When the manifesto was issued, we did not pledge ourselves to abandon our plural wives, nor even to cease to perform plural marriages outside of the government. And when our people get the idea that we have bound ourselves to the whole world, they manifest ignorance. A man may go to some countries and not violate their laws by taking a plural wife and living in plural marriage." Unquote. Furthermore, as Mike Quinn pointed out in his recent award-winning article in Dialogue, The evidence is overwhelming that President Woodruff not only violated his own directives in the manifesto by encouraging and approving plural marriages, but also married a post-manifesto wife himself. Despite church leaders' duplicity respecting the abandonment of polygamy, it must be remembered that as guardians of the church, their motivation was to protect individuals, including themselves and the institution and all its tenets, including plural marriage, at all costs. Situation ethics and matters related to polygamy had been practiced by the Mormon hierarchy since the early 1830s. For example, Joseph Smith, despite his numerous plural ceilings, always publicly denounced polygamy. On the 5th of October, 1843, the prophet and his scribe, Willard Richards, walked about the streets of Nauvoo and, according to Richards' entry in the prophet's journal of this date, quote, gave instructions to try those who were preaching, teaching, or practicing the doctrine of plurality of wives on this law. Joseph forbids it and the practice thereof. No man shall have but one wife, unquote. When incorporating this entry into the history of the church, Joseph Smith's cousin, Apostle George A. Smith, altered the passage to read, quote, this is in History of the Church, volume 6, page 46, gave instructions to try those persons who were preaching, teaching, or practicing the doctrine of plurality of wives. For according to the law, I hold the keys of this power in the last days. For there is never but one on earth at a time on whom the power and its keys are conferred. And I have constantly said, no man shall have but one wife at a time unless the Lord directs otherwise. This is a substantial difference between those two quotations, obviously. Apostle Matthias F. Cowley, in testimony before the Council of the Twelve in 1911, explained that the official church manner of dealing with the delicate matter of polygamy had not changed. Quote, I have always been taught that when the brethren were in a tight place, that it would not be amiss to lie to help them out. One of the presidency of the church made the statement some years ago that he would lie like hell to help his brethren, unquote. Unfortunately, this position was evident in the Reed Smoot hearings. The self-serving, often contradictory testimony of church leaders resulted in their being viewed as less than honest men. Reed Smoot's secretary, Carl Badger, wrote at the time, quote, I believe our honor is more to us than anything on earth, and we must keep our word sacred. If we wish to convert the world to the truths of polygamy, let us first be honest. If, as a people, we had strictly observed the manifesto, I believe that our example would have challenged the admiration of the world. But we have thought that there is something higher than honesty, and behold our confusion. I wish it could have been said to the Senate committee, come, gentlemen, bring your searchlights. Go into every corner. We will hide nothing. How proud we would be today if this were so. Simple honesty, the facts, publicity, a remedy from which we shrink. In an attempt to make church leaders' testimony credible to church members back in Utah, President Joseph F. Smith issued in 1904 what has been called the Second Manifesto. Quote, they charge us with being dishonest and untrue to our word, unquote, he said to the saints in General Conference. Quote again, they charge the church with having violated a compact and all this sort of nonsense. I want to see today whether the Latter-day Saints representing the church in this solemn assembly will not seal these charges as false by their vote, unquote. Despite a unanimous vote, most saints knew little or nothing of the covert post-manifesto polygamy that church leaders, including President Smith, had been supporting. Public confirmation of President Smith's statements proved nothing except that the church members were willing to follow the prophet. Martha has detailed for us a few of the nearly 20 subsequent mini-manifestos issued by Presidents Joseph Smith and Heber J. Grant, but she is being far too kind in analyzing the reasons why these statements had to be issued on a semi-regular basis. The reason church leaders after 1904 had to constantly attend to the brush fires of new polygamy is because they themselves had set the fires by publicly assailing for nearly 15 years what they were privately encouraging. From the earliest days of the church, when Joseph Smith secretly introduced plural marriage, it was understood to be the crowning jewel of Mormonism. Celestial and plural marriage were one and the same, the marriage pattern of the gods and all those who aspired to become like God. But after 1904, as Martha correctly points out, the church began to dismantle its carefully assembled rhetoric. Thus, celestial marriage is now considered eternal marriage. You can search through your gospel doctrine and priesthood manuals all day on the lesson respecting section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants. But history has been rewritten, you will find no mention that this revelation was given to persuade Emma Smith to allow Joseph Smith the wives he had already taken. Martha cites Charles W. Penrose in 1918 as saying, quote, "The keys of that power are given to one man at a time on the earth, and you will see sometime, if you cannot now, the wisdom of that law. He holds the key of that power, and when he turns it, as Brother Kimball, as Brother Woodruff did, it closes the door." Yet even President Spencer W. Kimball, in a private interview comment on his Aunt Fanny Woolley's post-manifesto plural marriage to George Parkinson, said, quote, "After President Smith had closed the door, not President Woodruff," unquote. Unfortunately, for the large number of secretly authorized plural marriages performed between 1890 and 1904, and the thousands of children born to these relationships, President Kimball's private posture is not recognized as the official position of the church, creating a genealogical nightmare for these families. I'm getting to the end of my time limit, but I would like to comment on Martha's observations on the church's involvement in providing information to law enforcement officials during the Boyd and Raid Crusades of 1944 and the Short Creek Raid of 1953. In retrospect, both proved financial and legal fiascos for the federal and state agencies involved. Blatant violations of civil rights were evident, and if anything, the raids created a core of heroes that are revered to this day by fundamentalists. Instead of remaining silent on the matter, as prudence would seem to dictate, church leaders through the Deseret News again sought to disassociate themselves from the polygamists, who were seen as a criminal element. Remember that Mormon leaders had ignored both Illinois' anti-polygamy laws in Nauvoo and a host of federal laws on the subject from 1862 to the late 1880s. This is the quote from the Deseret News. "Law-abiding citizens of Utah and Arizona," the editorial began, "owe a debt of gratitude to Arizona's Governor Howard Pyle and to his police officers, who Sunday raided the polygamous settlement at Short Creek and rounded up its leaders for trial. The existence of this community on our border had been an embarrassment to our people and a smudge on the reputations of our two great states. We hope Governor Pyle will make good his pledge to eradicate the illegal practices conducted there before they become a cancer of a sort that is beyond hope and human repair." Such anti-polygamy rhetoric was identical to that used by federal government leaders and the media during the anti-Mormon crusades of the 1870s and 1880s. And it hardly seems admirable for the Mormon position to have become one of persecutor rather than persecuted. Perhaps we would not be fighting the tide of rising fundamentalism today if we would have followed a wiser and certainly more Christian approach of live and let live. I applaud Martha Bradley and her fine paper, and I certainly encourage her and other scholars to continue their quest for the full historical details of Mormon polygamy. We owe it to future generations of Mormons to provide them with the facts on this controversial and relatively unresearched aspect of Mormonism. Thank you.
We have approximately 10 minutes left. I'll put the mic between our two speakers. You okay?
Okay. Oh, you're coming over. Okay.
The Attorney General's office gives the statistic of anywhere between 10 and 30,000 living polygamists in the state of Utah, bordering states Arizona and Nevada. That's a really rough estimate because, of course, it's very secretive.
Males?
No, that is a composite number. It's male, women, and their children. Uh-huh.
Sir?
Would you give me marriage? What is the date on that?
That's 1933, and you can get any of these different things that I've talked about through in the volume Messages of the First Presidency. They've been gathered together, and they're very, 1933. The disloyalty oath is also in Messages of the First Presidency. Well, I think I would refer you to Michael Quinn's fine article, which has recently been published in Dialogue. Very clearly, there was a period of ambiguity when what Joseph F. Smith was telling the world was very different from what was actually going on in the church, when plural marriages were being continually performed by apostles of the church, and that the original posture of the church was this was a public posture, not necessarily a doctrine.
Uh-huh.
I haven't done research on this, but again, Michael Quinn has. You know. Okay. Let me tell
you. You have to repeat it for me.
Okay. She wants to know if you have evidence of whether or not Anthony W. Ivins actually had letters from the First Presidency to tell him to perform marriages in Mexico.
Not a letter. That was a verbal instruction. But it was a... Mike Quinn details that very well in his article on polygamy, the circumstances behind that. There's a misconception there as to exactly when the date was, but he was taken aside and instructed by President Cannon exactly what how the marriage should be performed, what type of a letter that the bride and groom would be bringing with them so he would recognize that letter, and so forth. But that is also is mentioned by in several references by President Ivins' two sons, and that's in the Historical Society, the Anthony W. Ivins and Stan Ivins collections are there, and that's where the information comes from.
Okay.
That's in the, I haven't written that in my notes, but it's in the an oral history interview, which is in the oral history polygamy papers at the Red Center at BYU.
The New York Times, the headline in the New York Times was Hitler Hits Arizona, which is very interesting. This was, of course, very surprising to Howard Pyle, who was a very conservative Republican. Barry Goldwater was his campaign manager, and he thought this was going to bring him to the White House. He really did. He thought he was cleaning up the West, and he was very surprised that next morning when they were lambasted by this criticism.
I have a question. On in view of our view on civil rights today, is there a state in the United States where you can legally practice plural marriage?
Utah and Illinois are the only two states in the United States that have anti-polygamy legislation. So in any other state of the United States.
No, that's not true. States have laws against...
Arizona has anti-cohabitation legislation, anti-bigamy legislation, no anti-polygamy clause. That's why these cases were tried in Arizona courts rather than in Utah courts.
What about the federal government?
Well, you see, the additional marriages, polygamous marriages, are common law marriages, and Utah is really the only state which has hounded the polygamous. We're the only state that has had a tradition of legal prosecution against polygamy.
The federal laws do not apply to the states. They only apply mm-hmm. to territories, mm-hmm. and that would include the District of Columbia and other territories.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Constitution, marriage laws are
state concerns.
By the state.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Ma'am?
I'd like to ask the question. I think I understand the fundamentalist problem, but as you mentioned...
Can you speak louder, please?
The problem is that I think in polygamy is with those who were caught in the press, to say in Mexico and Canada, where it was practiced after the manifesto. Yet, I was wondering, I heard that recently in an era, or I mean in the Ensign, that it was indicated that those who were married after the manifesto, they were not. It was not accepted by the church. Do you know anything about that? You know, between 1890 and 1904.
The church officially recognizes no marriages. They do not recognize the legitimacy of the children born to all of the marriages, even though they were authorized by the president of the church between 1890 and 1904. So you have a catch-22 situation for those people. The as far as the genealogical programs for the church, the... husbands and wives cannot be sealed, and the children cannot be sealed to the parents.
She was wondering where.
Oh, there are several references. I detail that very well in my book, which will be published in December. It's a very complicated matter, but there are a lot of references on that.
Let me take a last question right here.
Yes, please.
There are just about as many statistics as there are studies that have been done to try. Anywhere from 10% to 20% is probably the accepted.
It's time for us to close. I'd like to thank you for coming to the session. One question for the audience. Would you please raise your hand if you are a descendant of a polygamous marriage? I thought we'd attract you people. Thanks very much for coming.